Welcome to ACT Radio, Animal Concerns of Texas. I'm Greg Lawson.
I'm Tom Linney.
And I'm Liz Walsh.
Here on ACT, we talk about how we humans relate to other animals.
We talk about how we use them for food, clothing, and entertainment, and how there are humane alternatives to these practices.
And we also discuss why a plant-based diet is the healthiest for humans and the best thing one can do for the environment.
So if you're concerned about your health, if you're concerned about the environment, if you're concerned about the way animals are treated, stay with us for Animal Concerns of Texas.
Coming up on today's show, we feature a conversation with Krista Schleyer. Krista is an award-winning photographer and writer focusing on conservation, biodiversity, and public lands. That's a little later in the show, but first some news.
The Trump administration has rescinded an Obama-era ban on the use of pesticides linked to declining bee populations. Also rescinded was a ban on the cultivation of genetically modified crops in dozens of national wildlife refuges where farming is permitted. 2 years ago, environmentalist groups sued to bring about the ban on neonicotinoid pesticides and GMO crops on federal land. A spokesman for the group Defenders of Wildlife said that lifting the restriction poses a grave threat to pollinating insects and other sensitive creatures who rely on toxic-free habitats afforded by wildlife refuges. The rollback, spelled out in a U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service memo, ends a policy that had prohibited farmers on refuges from planting GMO crops, such as soybeans and corn, engineered to resist pesticides and herbicides so that the soy and corn could be sprayed with larger amounts of these poisons. That policy also had barred the use on wildlife refuges of neonicotinoid pesticides in conjunction with GMO crops. Neonicotinoids are a class of insecticides tied by research to declining populations of bees and other pollinating insects around the world. The European Union has a complete ban on neonicotinoid pesticides. Fish and Wildlife Service Deputy Director Greg Sheehan said removing the ban was needed to ensure adequate forage for migratory birds, including ducks and geese, which is strange because last spring, the Trump administration trashed the century-old Migratory Bird Act treaty, which protected migratory birds. Ducks and geese are favored by hunters on many of the nation's refuges. U.S. Secretary of the Interior Ryan Zinke, whose department oversees the Fish and Wildlife Service, has made expansion of hunting on public lands a priority for his agency. Soon we'll have to find some other euphemism for sex. Parents won't be able to have a talk with their kids about the birds and the bees because the kids won't know what they're talking about.
From One Green Planet, the vegan restaurant Next Level Burger will be opening its first Texas location at an outpost inside Whole Foods Market on Lamar Boulevard in Austin. This fantastic burger joint offers plant-based burgers, hot dogs, and even milkshakes. Not only are these mouthwatering goodies 100% vegan, they're also made using organic, fair trade, and sustainable ingredients. Next Level Burger was founded in 2014 and has expanded to 5 more locations in Oregon, Washington, California, and New York. The idea behind Next Level Burger is to provide healthy, environmentally responsible, and delicious food, a goal which they're easily meeting. The restaurant is a welcome addition to the regular burger brands, especially since more and more Americans understand the benefits of choosing plant-based options and are trying to incorporate such foods and meals into their diet. More people than ever are open to trying meatless burgers. This incredible shift is largely motivated by millennials, as it's estimated around 64% have tried meatless burgers. This plant-based meat category is also seeing an incredible amount of growth and is projected to hit a net worth of $5.2 by 2020. With delicious options like the plant-based Beyond Sausage, vegan BLTs, grilled cheese, barbecue blue cheese fries, and cheesy chili tater tots, it's really no surprise that Next Level Burger is a favorite for anyone who is trying to eat less meat, but still enjoys delicious, decadent food.
The Center for Biological Diversity reports that conservation groups filed a formal protest to stop large-scale logging of old-growth trees in the Prescott National Forest in critical habitat for the threatened Mexican spotted owl and northern goshawk. The U.S. Forest Service has authorized the greater than 234,000-acre Hassayampa Landscape Restoration Project that would allow private companies to log across more than half of the owl's primary habitat and nearly all of the goshawk's preferred habitat, with no limits on cutting what remains of Prescott's iconic old growth and large trees. Joe Trudeau, Southwest advocate for the Center of Biological Diversity, states that targeting dense stands of large old trees that spotted owls desperately need is incredibly destructive, and that it's mind-boggling that the Forest Service is failing to provide any protection for this critical habitat. Once these magnificent trees and wildlife are gone from the Prescott National Forest, they're gone for good. Numerous Forest Service documents have identified a lack of large old trees in Prescott National Forest, with data showing that only a handful of trees larger than 18 inches in diameter remain. That compares to an overabundance of small trees, which fuel uncharacteristic wildfires. Thomas Labatt, conservation chair for the Sierra Club's Yavapai Group, states that natural fire regimes must be restored to the Prescott National Forest's diverse ecosystems, and that forest restoration can't come at the expense of sensitive wildlife, old-growth forests, streams, trails, and the enjoyment of our public lands. Removing large, old, fire-resistant trees and leaving logging slash on steep slopes will increase fire risk. The Hassayampa Restoration Project will set the course for forest management in the next 30 years across what remains of the old-growth forest in the Bradshaw Mountains. In their protests, the conservation groups explained that restoring fire-dependent forests depends on thinning small-diameter trees, not cutting down the last large remaining fire-resistant trees. The groups also say the agency used insufficient data in its environmental analysis. To learn more, go to www.biologicaldiversity.org.
Stick around. Coming up next is a conversation with Krista Slyer, an award-winning photographer and writer focusing on conservation, biodiversity, and public lands. She's worked throughout North America, from the arid borderlands of the American West and fire forests of the Southeast to the urban rivers of Washington, D.C. She's a winner of the Ansel Adams Award for Conservation Photography, National Outdoor Book Award, and Vision Award from the North American Nature Photographers Association. She's contributed stories and photography to the BBC, National Parks, Defenders, Audubon, and the Nature Conservancy. Her stories and other publications have focused on wildlife like the desert tortoise, bison, prairie dog, and larger environmental issues including climate change, wildlife migration corridors, and urban waterways. Slyer has been documenting the U.S.-Mexico borderlands and the changes brought about by U.S. border and immigration policy. She's the author of the nationally recognized book, Continental Divide, Wildlife, People, and the Border Wall, as well as Almost Anywhere, Road Trip Ruminations on Love, Nature, National Parks, and Nonsense, and River of Redemption, Almanac of Life on the Anacostia, which will be released in November 2018. That's next on ACT Radio. Joining us now on Animal Concerns of Texas is Krista Slyer. Thanks for being with us, Krista.
Hi, it's great to be here.
Hi, Krista. Could you start by telling our listeners how you got involved in animal protection issues?
Yeah, sure. I think probably started when I was really young. I just have always had a real connection to animals. And my parents would tell me a story about the first time I ever visited a zoo, and I was watching the giraffes, and the zookeeper came along and was feeding marshmallows to the giraffes, and one of the, which is a thing in and of itself.
Totally natural. Totally natural.
Yeah, but also one of the marshmallows fell in a crack, and this giraffe, it was trying to get its face in the crack, and I think I was like maybe 2 or 3 years old, and I don't know if I can say this on the radio, but I said something like, "You damn dummy." Sorry, I hope that's okay. But yeah, I think I've just always had a connection to animals. And then probably about 20 years ago, I was going through some really hard times in my life personally. And I just turned to spending time with wildlife and photographing wildlife. And it seemed to be one of the only things that really gave me peace. And so after that, I just started working my career and my life towards trying to be a voice for animals, and particularly for wildlife and ecosystems.
Where were the first places in nature that you got out to?
Well, the first where I took a trip in 2001, 2002. I lived in a car and just went to national parks and national forests, national wildlife refuges for a year all around the country. Wow. And took photographs and just spent time, you know, observing and being in wild spaces. So that's kind of where I started. And so I was working on national parks issues at that point. And then I started working with Defenders of Wildlife in a few years after that. And not long after that, I started working on stories about the U.S.-Mexico borderlands and how border policy was impacting wildlife and ecosystems.
Yeah, in your book, Continental Divide is a beautiful photo essay and talks a little bit about that. Can you tell our listeners a little bit about how that book came together?
Yeah, so I originally started on the Border Project because I was working on a story for Wildlife Conservation Magazine, and it was about the herd of bison that travels across the border in the boot heel of New Mexico. And that story sort of launched me on this project to try and raise awareness about not only the peril that border policy and border walls pose to the environment, but just about the beauty of the U.S.-Mexico borderlands and very special ecological values that it has in North America. And so I've been working on that for probably 3 years, and I had done a book with Texas A&M University Press about whooping cranes, and just mentioned to them that I was doing this project on the border, and they were really excited to work on that with me. And so that book came out in 2012, and it's really all about the natural history of the borderlands, about the wildlife and the ecosystems, and the utterly unique place that it is because it's at this natural borderlands at the meeting of the temperate and the tropic worlds. So the book's about that, but also sort of puts it in the context of border policy and how border policy has changed over the past decades and what that's meant for the wild world along the borderlands.
You know, I didn't realize that construction of the border wall dates back to 2005 or so until I read an article by you. I thought it was, you know, just Trump's idea, but no, it dates back in the Bush era, right?
Yeah, unfortunately, the bulk of the border wall that exists now was built well before the Trump administration. It's an old idea, and the first miles of border wall on the border, the significant border wall anyway, were built under the Clinton administration in the 1990s.
Wow.
And they were very limited to urban environments. But that kind of began this policy of escalating militarization on the border. And you're right, in 2006, under the Secure Fence Act, was when major expansion of border wall began under the Bush administration.
And we have a big piece of the original border wall right near us, Greg, right in Sunland Park, New Mexico. That was one of the first segments that was constructed, as well as along the border here in the Rio Grande by El Paso. I think we've all seen that
as
we drive to work every day.
And Krista, the Real ID Act, was probably around that time, right, of 2006, 2007?
It was right before, actually. So the Real ID Act was a part, was 2005 was when it passed. And there was a very little-known provision of the Real ID Act, which was a huge, sprawling piece of legislation. But Section 102 allowed the Department of Homeland Security to waive all laws to construct a segment of border wall in San Diego. And the reason why they did that was because there had been attempts to build expanded border wall there in San Diego, but because of really important environmental concerns with endangered species and watershed protection, environmental groups had stalled that construction. And legal protections that we had in place at the time, Clean Water Act, Clean Air Act, Endangered Species Act, gave protections to wildlife and to waters. And so in 2005, when the Real ID Act was passed, they included this provision that allowed all laws to be waived to build that segment of wall in San Diego. But unfortunately, a year later, in 2006, the Secure Fence Act was passed. And the Bush administration used the authority under the Real ID Act, even though it was actually intended just for that section in San Diego, but they used it to build the 700 miles of wall that were mandated under the Secure Fence Act. So all of that wall, all of the wall that we have right now, which is actually more like about 670 miles, was built without any thought to protections for wildlife and clean air and clean water and historical values and really pretty much every other legal protection that we have on the book.
Yeah, I mean, it leaves you thinking, I mean, what's the point of having the Endangered Species Act and the Clean Air Act, and if they're not even going to, you know, follow them, and they're just going to pick and choose when they decide to enforce them?
Yeah, exactly. If they're only, you know, abided by when they're convenient, it's not a very effective law.
Yeah, and I would imagine it's hard, too, for many people that don't understand the biodiversity in this area. Like you mentioned earlier, for people who haven't spent a lot of time in the border, maybe you can paint a little bit of a portrait of how diverse and what kinds of animals live along the long border.
Yeah, so it's a spectacular place. The more I learn about it, the more amazed I am about the number, the type, the diversity of species that depend on this landscape. One of the things I always try to talk about is that there's more wild cat diversity in the borderlands than any other place in North America. So there are six species of cats in North America, and five of them live in the U.S.-Mexico borderlands. And three of them are critically endangered, the jaguar, the ocelot, and the jaguarundi. And all three of those depend heavily on the ability to migrate back and forth across the border. There's the Sky Islands ecosystem, which most people have never heard of, but it's this really unique ecosystem that exists in arid locations where there are mountains. So you have, at the lowest elevations, you have desert, and you have all these incredible desert species. It's not just sand and deserts. It's incredible cactus and reptiles and wildflowers and birds and all sorts of other species. And then as you go up in elevation, the climate starts to change, so you get more rainfall and cooler temperatures, and so there's all these species that can exist as you go up these mountainsides that can't exist in the desert. So it's this incredibly condensed biodiversity. I've heard scientists refer to it as, you know, if you started at the desert floor and went to the top of the mountain in southern Arizona, it would be the same from a biological perspective as going from Mexico to the boreal forests in Canada, because the life changes that much. So there's that, and there's the lower Rio Grande Valley is it actually sits at basically at the midpoint between the tropic zone and the temperate zone, and so it's the it's the furthest south that there. Point in the United States, that in Florida. But the lower Rio Grande Valley has this incredible diversity of birds, some of the highest bird and butterfly diversity in the United States and Canada. So North America, north of Mexico, the highest diversity of species is here in the lower Rio Grande Valley. And there's also jaguarundis and ocelots, tremendous insect diversity. You know, you see all of these birds in this place that are sitting in, like a gran jeno tree, and they might be northern cardinals, which we see where I live in Washington, D.C., but they might be sitting right next to a green jay, which is a tropical species, or an Altamira oriole, which is more of a regional endemic species, and just a mind-blowing diversity of wildlife that lives in the lower Rio Grande Valley. And one of the really unique things that's important about the border issue in terms of the valley is that most of the habitat in that region has been destroyed. It's been converted into agriculture fields or energy development or residential development, and less than 4% of the native habitat remains. And along the Rio Grande River, less than 1% of the riparian forest remains. And, of course, the river is the border, so any damage that's done to habitat there is destroying and fragmenting some of the last habitat on Earth for some of these species.
Yeah,
it's very, very depressing when you hear about what's going on with some of the wildlife refuges and other reserves down in the Rio Grande Valley. It's very concerning.
So, and Krista, I think, too, something that, you know, for some people, they think, okay, well, the animals will just evolve. But you know, the walls are going up, you know, they go up quickly, and they don't have an opportunity, obviously, after, you know, many thousands of years. But it also affects, like, seed distribution, right, and how the plants and the rest of the ecosystem is not just wildlife.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you know, one example of that is javelina. And javelina are seed distributors. And so when they eat, for instance, prickly pear cactus, they ingest the seeds. And then when they move north, so can the cactus. And a lot of plants rely on this type of dispersal of their seeds, whether it's in the guts of an animal or in the fur of a coyote or a wolf. There's all this evidence that, say, the saguaro cactus has been moving north over the past centuries. And all plants, all living creatures will migrate when climate change demands it. And of course, we're in this situation right now where droughts are increasing in the Southwest, and temperatures are getting hotter for more extended periods. And so this is exactly the time when plants are going to need to be able to move along with animals. Mm. And so any barrier we put up is going to really harm their ability to be able to adapt to changing climate.
And as you mentioned, altering the flow of water along the border, which at least in our area here in El Paso and in the Southwest, it's very dry, and these water courses like the San Pedro River are some of the most important for wildlife, and potentially they could be important for humans for water sources too, to alter the drainage patterns around the border is also one of the consequences of the border wall.
Yes, absolutely. There was an example a few years ago. There have been several examples since the 700 or so, a little bit less than 700 miles of border wall were built in the 2008-2009. But one example that I think is a really important example for wild species is that in the lower Rio Grande Valley, what's happening is that the border wall is not being built on the border, which is the river, because, you know, it's the river and the river floods. And so instead, the border wall is being built at the Rio Grande levee, which sits a mile or two inland from the actual river. And so all of this land between where they're building the border wall and the river is now in this sort of no man's land situation. And much of that land is National Wildlife Refuge land. So this wall is being built into the levee. The levee the levee has been an earthen berm, so it's relatively tall, but it has a relatively gentle slope that most wildlife can get over. But what they're doing is they're putting in 20 feet of a vertical concrete wall instead of that gentle earthen berm, and wildlife species obviously cannot get over that. And there was a big flood in 2010 in the lower Rio Grande Valley, and floodwaters inundated National Wildlife Refuge property for many, many weeks, in some cases months. And Fish and Wildlife Service, after the floodwaters had receded, they went around and they collected all of these Texas tortoise shells from tortoises that had drowned in the floodwaters because they couldn't escape over the levee. And they made the assumption that many, many other wild species drowned, but because they didn't have remains that were as hardy as the Texas tortoise, that they would never be found and they could never be counted. So those kind of impacts are extreme critical impacts to many, many species. And the Texas tortoise is an imperiled species. They have very little habitat left, and now the habitat that's left to them has become a danger to them.
What about mitigating some of these impacts? Is there much being done that, you know, that's proactive?
Well, back in, when the initial Secure Fence Act was passed and the years following that, there was a lot of attempt to try and get mitigation funding for the damages that would be caused. And, of course, a lot of the damage can never be mitigated, because if there's a wall and wildlife can't get past it, there's not a lot that you can do. But they did try to put in, specifically for ocelots in South Texas, they tried to put in what they called cat doors. It was kind of a pilot project to see if these ocelots would go through these cat doors in the wall. And what they found through the studies is that the ocelots would not use the cat doors, in large part because ocelots they're very secretive creatures. They don't go out in the open. And all of the land around the border wall where they constructed is cleared for usually up to 60 to 100 feet. So there's this open space, and then there's this wall, and it's, the open space is almost as much of a barrier to an ocelot as the wall itself. Mm-hmm. And so ocelots wouldn't use it, but they did find that some other creatures would use it, like snakes and frogs and that type of a thing. So it's not that there isn't some way to lessen the damage to some species, but there's no way to completely mitigate the damage to species in general.
Or like the Sonoran pronghorn that Greg was talking about, how do you mitigate isolating populations and then all of the genetic consequences that occur through having small numbers of individuals in small breeding populations. It's just, like you said, it's not possible to mitigate that, really.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, one of the other things, the studies that had been done was on bobcat populations in South Texas, and it was a similar story, except for bobcats are not an endangered species, and snorm pronghorn are. But what happened was they collared the bobcats after the wall was built because they knew it was going to fragment an already, you know, very small landscape for them to be able to exist on. And what they found was the mortality of bobcats went up after the wall was built because the aggression between males, bobcat males, increased because the fragmentation of their landscape made it so that they didn't have enough space to be able to coexist. You know, they need large spaces for a male to be able to find mates and find prey. So they will fight over that habitat. And so more bobcats were fighting, more bobcats were dying from those fights, and more bobcats were striking out to try to find new habitat, and so they were getting killed on roads. So that type of impact is another one to be concerned about.
You know, Krista, on your website, I was watching the trailer for the film Think Like a Scientist, Boundaries, and in it, there's a wildlife biologist, and in the film, he says, it always helps to take a different perspective other than your own. You know, essentially put yourself in another's shoes or paws. And I couldn't think of a better way to sum up how we need to approach this border wall issue from a human rights, from an environmental, from an animal protection perspective. But I'm wondering if you can tell our listeners where they can go to learn more about your beautiful work and potentially hopefully get inspired to do the right thing here.
Oh, absolutely. Thank you. You can definitely get my book, which is called Continental Divide, Wildlife, People, and the Border Wall. You can find that just about anywhere, but if you have a local bookstore, you can go ask them to order it or get it on Amazon or whatever. My website is KristaSchleier.com, and there's a lot of information on there. Some of the films that I've worked on, I have an exhibit that travels around the country, so I try to keep updated on Facebook and Twitter where that exhibit is. It's going to Yale over the next few months, and then it's going to be in New York at Vassar after that, and it travels around the country, and hopefully we'll get it to El Paso sometime soon. And, you know, I'm Krista Schleier on Facebook, and, you know, one of the best ways is to follow me there, and I post not only my own projects that I'm working on, but I try to post all of the different work that's being done on the borderlands, because one of the good, really positive things that's happening right now is that a lot more people are getting engaged in this, and they're understanding the damage that this is going to do to wildlife populations and ecosystems and people on the borderlands, and they want to help. So there's a lot of great stuff going on, and you can find out some about that by following me on Facebook.
We've been talking with award-winning photographer and writer Krista Schleier. Thanks for being with us, Krista.
Thanks so much. It's great to be here.
Thanks.
Yeah, thanks, Krista.
Thank you.
As school's starting, you might be wondering what your child will be eating for lunch. A recent initiative by the Vegetarian Society of El Paso is to educate local chefs about plant-based diets. If you know of a chef that might be interested in attending, go to the Vegetarian Society of El Paso's website at vsep.org.
Also at vsep.org, you'll find out some about the many events planned by the Vegetarian Society. We have cooking classes, restaurant hoppers, potlucks, dinners with speakers, and many other events. That's at vsep.org.
And if you'd like to listen to some of the past shows of ACK Radio, you can find them at ktep.org. Just click on the listen button. Until next time, I'm Tom Linney.
I'm Greg Lawson.
And I'm Liz Walsh for the Earth, the Animals, and a Healthier Humanity. Thanks for listening to Animal Concerns of Texas.